President Trump does not bluff, and he is prepared to unleash hell. Iran should not miscalculate again. Any violence beyond this point will be because the Iranian regime refused to understand they have already been defeated and refused to come to a deal.
Well, that explains it. And by the way, hasn't he already unleashed hell?
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight.
On all of us.
I got the feeling that something ain't right.
Please stop.
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair.
So much winning.
And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
Yes, I am. From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is The Bradcast, as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA and on dozens of other fine affiliate stations on both the public airwaves and the internets around the country and the world, blanketing planet Earth. I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, an all-round swell fellow, says me from bradblog.com. Thank you very much for joining us today. Our friends Digby and Driftglass are standing by to join us momentarily, Desi Doyen.
Yes, they are.
So I won't make this too long. We'll see. They'll be joining us for our latest roundtable roundup of the past several very slow news weeks since we last checked in with them. But first, a few news items of note overnight. Democrat Emily Gregory has won a special election on Tuesday for the Florida State House District that includes Donald Trump's Mar-a-Lago Resort, which is also his home where he is registered to vote. As discussed on yesterday's program, he voted in the special election by absentee ballot, even while continuing to decry absentee voting and trying to prevent millions of Americans from doing exactly as he did in this election. Gregory's stunning win on Tuesday flipped the state legislative seat from Republican to Democratic control in Florida. Trump's own home district is now represented by a Democrat in the Florida State House. Gregory beat Republican John Maples, whom Trump gave his, quote, complete and total endorsement to, in the race for a seat that Governor Ron DeSantis has kept vacant since last August, fearing, apparently, what happened on Tuesday. Even as late as Monday, Trump had posted on his failing social media site in favor of the Republican Maples, saying that he was backed, quote, by so many of my Palm Beach County friends. Guess Donald Trump doesn't have all that many friends left in Palm Beach anymore either. Gregory reportedly won by about 51% of the vote to 49% for Maples as of late Tuesday night. Trump carried this very Florida legislative district by about 11 percentage points back in 2024, according to the down ballot. So that's another about a 12-point swing toward the Democrat in Trump's own home district, close to the average 13 points or so swing that we have seen towards Democrats in special elections around the country since Trump took office again last year. The last Republican who held the seat actually won his election by 19 points back in 2024, before being appointed as Palm Beach County Clerk and vacating that seat. Florida's 87th district is the 10th GOP-held state legislative seat that Democrats have flipped around the country since Trump took office last year again. Republicans have not flipped any Democratic state legislative seats over that same period. Overall, according to AP, it was the 29th seat that Democrats have flipped from Republican control since Trump took office again, and what is starting to look like somewhat of a pattern here. Gregory, a public health expert, is also the 11th, oh, you like this, Des?
Okay.
The 11th scientist to win a special election this cycle.
Excellent.
And the 5th scientist to flip a GOP-held seat. That, according to 314 Action, a national organization working to elect Democrats with backgrounds in science and medicine at all levels of government. Since the start of this year alone, notes CNN, Democrats have flipped seats in Arkansas, New Hampshire, and Texas, and yes, now Florida. Democrats have also notched some other notable wins in Republican-controlled Florida. In December, Eileen Higgins won the race for Miami mayor there, the first time that a Democrat had led the city in nearly three decades. She defeated the Trump-endorsed Republican in a campaign that leaned heavily into criticism of the president's immigration crackdown, a message that appears to have resonated with the city's large Hispanic population for some reason. Out farther in the West, in Texas, Democrat Taylor Remmert flipped a reliably Republican state Senate district in a special election back in January. Trump, you'll recall that he immediately distanced himself from that loss in the district where he had won by 17 points in 2024. He said, quote, "I'm not involved in that," unquote, even though he had endorsed the Republican candidate in the race. Of course, winning on Trump's literal home turf of Mar-a-Lago is an especially big deal for the Democrats. Florida Democratic Party Chair Nikki Fried crowed in a joint statement with the Palm Beach County Democratic Party, saying, quote, "Democrats can run and win anywhere, including Donald Trump's backyard." Trump cast his mail-in ballot in the special election backing Maples, the former council member in Lake Clark Shores, in both the special primary and the special general election, exhorting social media followers to turn out to vote. Gregory, however, for her part, was running for office for the very first time. She campaigned on rising costs and promised that she would focus on that issue if elected. Maples touted his business experience and he pledged to cut taxes. But that old chestnut did not seem to work as well as it used to, apparently, for Republicans, apparently even in Trump land. The Palm Beach County race was one of three legislative special elections on the ballot around Florida on Tuesday, with a fourth decided by default after the Republican candidate ran unopposed. Hey, Florida Dems, why the hell did you let that happen? If a Democrat could win, it seems to me, in a Trump plus 11 district where Trump lives, I'd say that, well, Nikki Fried is right. Democrats can win anywhere in Florida. Someone should let the Florida Democratic Party chair, Nikki Fried, know about that, said Gregory to her supporters on her at her election night party on Tuesday. Quote, "When we started this, nobody thought it was possible. They thought we were crazy. I knew we deserved better, a leader who will fight for us." Also on Tuesday, Republican Hillary Holley held a state house seat in Central Florida for her party. But the other Tuesday night special election race for a Tampa area state Senate seat is still too close to call. Democrat Brian Nathan is leading Republican Josie Tomcow by less than half a percentage point as of now, by about 400 votes out of some 80,000 tallied in the state Senate district, yes, previously held by the GOP.
Hmm.
So that is now looking likely to become another red-to-blue flip for Democrats this year in the previously, anyway, very red state of Florida. While domestic politics continue to look encouraging for the Democratic Party in advance of the critical 2026 midterm elections, the outlook for the world under Mad King Donald appears, well, somewhat less encouraging. U.S. President Donald Trump's surprising claim this week that talks with Iran were yielding such great progress that he had decided to cancel his vow to commit more war crimes against Iran by targeting civilian power plants that provide energy to some 92 million people in the country on Monday night. He decided to extend that deadline for those bombings by 5 days for now. But his claim of great progress in those talks with Iran only raised, well, more confusion over a war whose goals were already confusing and unclear, according to AP, with the most basic question being, what talks? There seemed to be none ongoing at the time, at least according to Iran, which said neither direct nor indirect talks were taking place with the U.S. at the time that Trump appeared to chicken out of his attack on Iranian power plants if they refused to relinquish control of the Strait of Hormuz, where Iran has predictably prevented the shipping of about a fifth of the world's oil and gas supplies. A 15-point plan from the Trump administration offering a pathway to an exit was offered late on Tuesday to Iran through Pakistan. But by Wednesday, Iran had rejected that plan and vowed to fight on, quote, until complete victory. Though they did present a 5-point counter proposal of their own that included a demand that the U.S. pay reparations for the damage that it has caused to the nation and that Iran would continue to exercise sovereign control of the strait. That comes on the heels of Trump on Tuesday confidently stating that he himself might be placed in charge of the Strait of Hormuz, according to the apparently imaginary talks that his son-in-law Jared Kushner and real estate buddy Steve Witkoff were said to be holding with the top person in Iran, who Trump refused to identify for some reason.
What about the Strait of Hormuz? Who's going to be in control of that?
That'll be opened very soon, if this works.
How soon? And who's in control of it? Will Iran still be able to control the flow of oil?
Be jointly controlled.
By whom?
Maybe me.
You want the United States to be in
me
control?
Me and the Ayatollah, whoever the Ayatollah is, whoever the next Ayatollah.
Well, that sounds totally legit. If anything, the war appears to only be escalating at this point, according to AP. Barrages were fired into Iran, Israel, and across the Mideast on Tuesday. Meanwhile, anywhere from 3 to 10,000 more U.S. Marines were reportedly on their way to the Gulf, and the Army was preparing to deploy anywhere from 1 to 3,000 paratroopers from the 82nd Airborne Division in what is sure beginning to look, anyway, like a plan for U.S. boots on the ground in another Middle Eastern war. All of that as average gas prices around the U.S. are now barely under $4 a gallon as we go to air, probably at or above $4 by tomorrow. And as a seemingly increasingly out of touch Donald Trump on Tuesday repeated his bizarre claims about how the U.S. has long ago already won this war. Quote, we're talking to the right leaders and they want to make a deal so badly, Trump said of the talks that were happening, quote, right now, adding, quote, we really have regime change, you know. This is a change in the regime because the leaders are all very different than the ones that we started off with that created all of these problems. Apparently, Trump was talking about the U.S. assassination of Iran's extremist 86-year-old supreme leader being replaced by his younger, reportedly more extreme 56-year-old son as supreme leader. Nonetheless, as Trump made clear once again on Tuesday.
You know, I don't like to say this. We've won this. This war has been won. The only one that likes to keep it going is the fake news. I mean, the New York Times, you read the New York Times, it's like, we're not winning a war where they have no Navy and they have no Air Force and they have no nothing. And we literally have planes flying over Tehran and other parts of their country. They can't do a thing about it.
Can't do a thing other than shut down a fifth of the world's oil and gas supply and send the global economy hurtling toward a worldwide recession. Though we are winning so much that we are now deploying thousands of troops to the region. Because mission accomplished? Joining us now are our fellow old school blogger friends who have, well, ridden with us through similar rodeos before. Heather Digby Parton is the award-winning longtime columnist at Salon and proprietor of the beloved Digby's Hullabaloo blog and the man known only as Driftglass, though occasionally as Bill. He is the proprietor of his own eponymously named blog and co-host of the professional left podcast brought to you straight from the cornfield resistance of what he describes as flyover country, Illinois. Hey, welcome back to both of you guys to the broadcast.
Hey, everybody.
Good to be here.
No one believes you, Heather. Anyway, it seems like both yesterday and forever ago, since you were both here, you joined us. Believe it or not, it was just after the State of the Union address this year. Trump was crowing at the time about low gas prices, a booming stock market. He had obliterated Iran's nuclear program last year. Turns out that was just 4 days before Trump and Israel launched their new war on Iran, which is now in its fourth week with seemingly no real end in sight, it seems to me. Heather, it was all going so golden agey when we last spoke. And he told us it was. And then, you know, just days later, boom, what happened there? What happened in the interim, Heather?
Well, it is very interesting that he had this big, you know, a platform to speak to the American people. You know, everybody's tuned in. Well, not everybody. It was very low rated by State of the Union standards. But nonetheless, there were many millions of people listening, or at least, you know, paying some attention to the president and what he said, that, you know, where the country was. And of course, he lied, you know, of course he did, and hyped all kinds of total nonsense. But nonetheless, it is very interesting that within days, we ended up in a brand new war. And he said, I don't know what it was. It was something like maybe, you know, 30 seconds devoted to Iran in it and barely mentioned it.
Yep.
And clearly, you know, he was getting ready to launch a major war in the Middle East and didn't say a word about it. Now, normally, this is, you know, even the worst of them, you know, let's talk about George W. Bush for a minute. As awful as that was, and that run up to the Iraq War, they did make an attempt. Now, granted, they lied. They, you know, did all kinds of backflips. They twisted the intelligence. They did many things. But they understood that if you're going to launch a major war, that you're going to have to explain it to the American people and at least make the attempt to get them, you know, on your side. And often presidents, as a result of that, when the war starts, they get a rally around the flag effect. And, you know, people do sort of say, well, you know, rah, rah, got to, you know, vote for America on this one. And they do it. He did not do any of that. He launched it more or less as a surprise attack, which he joked around with the new prime minister of Japan the other day about how the Japanese know from surprise attacks, right? I mean, that was one of the more humiliating moments.
There have been many.
But, you know, he basically did not, you know, say a word. Now, it's not that we didn't know that this was potentially happening. They were gathering ships for some time. But I think what everybody thought was that this was sort of a gesture to perhaps to help Israel sort of, you know, make some kind of, you know, launch some kind of an attack on Iran without the United States actually getting involved, or that this would be somehow get the Iranians to agree to the peace deal that they were alleged, you know, and the nuclear deal that they were supposedly talking about with the two diplomatic geniuses, Steve Witkoff and Jared Kushner in charge.
Let me jump in on that, because and sort of just to push back a little bit, because you say during that State of the Union, he knew that he was going to be going to war in what was just 4 days later. I'm not sure that he actually did. I mean,
well, you may be right.
I mean, because apparently the talks were going very well. And apparently just on the Friday before the Saturday morning attack in Tehran, everyone thought that, you know, that there was a good deal moving forward. The talks were going well. Apparently, Iran had made a bunch of concessions that apparently Witkoff and Kushner did not actually understand in translation, as is being reported. But I'm not so sure that Trump even knew during his Tuesday State of the Union that he would be going to war by Friday. It seems like he just decided to pull the trigger for some reason at that point.
He did. I'm sure that that's what happened. And we've seen this before with the, you know, he's done this from the moment that he came in. He did that with the pardons for all the January 6th people. You know, they had it all worked out that they were going to be only the violent ones were going to be left, and they'd pardon the ones who weren't nonviolent and all that stuff. And he just apparently looked at it and went, F it.
Yeah, he couldn't stand. He couldn't stand all, to go, you know, through it one by one.
Yeah, he didn't, it was too complicated, and he just went, you know, to heck with that. Let's just do it. Or, you know, yeah, more crudely put. But in the as far as this is concerned, I could see that happening. Now, apparently, we know that he had the Prime Minister of Israel, Netanyahu, in his ear. He had MBS in Saudi Arabia, apparently, in his ear. That was reported this week, pushing him to continue the war. And then you had little Lindsey Graham in his ear saying that you're going to be the greatest, you know, leader since Alexander the Great if you do this. And so there was that kind of pressure coming from people and other people from the outside who were saying, and meanwhile, apparently there were people within the administration, including the Joint Chiefs of Staff, were going, whoa, okay, can we hold up a little bit here? You know, this isn't, we're not ready, or they didn't think that this was going to, well, there was no real plan other than just bombing them back into the Stone Age. So, yeah, I think it was an impulsive decision, and I think that's very possible that he didn't know. Nonetheless, you would have thought that he would have at least made the case at the State of the Union against Iran. I mean,
he would have.
But he could have said, you know, this is a bad thing, and we need to be on the lookout and what have you. But again, he thought that if he did this, and I think he was convinced of this, that it was going to be Venezuela, that, well, you know, the Ayatollahs would all, you know, they would fold
on the first day. Well, you're right.
Like, oh, we're sorry, sir, we're so sorry. What can we do to make a deal?
And you would have thought he would have at least tried to make a case if he knew. That's why I'm saying that I think he didn't even know himself that he was going to go drift glass.
But anybody thought they were going. Yeah.
Right. Drift glass, we've gone through some dumb wars over the years for questionable reasons, but this one in particular, for a president who claimed to be against dumb foreign wars when he was running for office, at least as much as he wanted to, you know, release all of the Epstein files during that same campaign, it seems like this is a particularly stupid war, even by U.S. standards. As a policy matter, as a political matter, Driftglass, why do you think he started this thing?
I think if you take the Iraq war, the lead up to it, the war profiteering from it, all the lies about it, and you put it into a compression machine and shrinky-dink it down to something dumber and louder and more corrupt and more ridiculous, this is what you get. Mm. And I would say this is what you get with Republican presidents. Mm. We can now draw a straight line from the Bush administration to this, because the Bush administration did exactly the same thing in a much broader, more witness-driven way. They told better lies. They had Colin Powell out there lying for them. But there was a great deal of war profiteering going on. There were billions of dollars that just disappeared into the sands of Iraq, and on and on and on, along with the justification shifting every now and then and changing every now and then. And those people were not punished for that. The Republican right. Party was not punished for that.
Yep.
Republican voters got off the hook.
Yep.
It was like it never happened. They just moved on to hating Barack Obama without breaking stride. And that is the party that Donald Trump took over, who were ready to follow a dear leader anywhere he wants to go.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, yeah, it was an impulsive decision. Sure it was. But all of his decisions are impulsive. And I think, you know, there's a character from Star Trek, the first season, Colonel Green of the original series, who was notable, brought back from the 20th century, because he was notable for attacking people during negotiations.
Mm.
I think Trump just thought, well, we got him to the table, we got him talking, let's kill them all, and then it'll be great. And I think that has taught the Iranian government and everybody else on the planet a very important lesson, which is you cannot negotiate with Donald Trump in good faith, ever. Because he'll kill you. The minute you show up to the meeting, he'll drop a bomb on your head. And that is so incredibly dangerous. I can't even begin to quantify it. But it is entirely his war, and it is entirely his doing. And watching the Republican Party, especially the Republican base, sort of tear themselves apart like a German kinetic sculpture from the 20s, trying to figure out, what am I supposed to believe? How am I supposed to react to this? Because they have no idea. This is completely unknown territory to them. I'll know what this is like because we went through it. And we were protesting it at the time, back when it was George W. Bush. And we kept up the flame, if I pat ourselves on the back a little bit, reminding people that the Republican Party is the problem. The entire party is the problem. Lindsey Graham is a proxy for the rest of them. Mm. And here we are inheriting the legacy of what George Bush put on the table. And Dick Cheney, by the way, before he passed away, was interviewed, I can't remember where, said, no, I think we did great. I have no apologies. Yeah. I would do it all over again. And so you have this party that's inherently unapologetic for anything. They cannot admit they're wrong. And now they're trapped between the irresistible force of, I can never admit I made a mistake, and the immovable object of Iran. And it turns out when you do that, the answer is hamada, hamada, hamada. It's you just make crap up on the fly to make sure the base, at least that 25 or 26% stays on side, because that's all Trump cares about at this point. The only people he cares about are that tiny sliver of lunatics and bigots who still support him no matter what.
And one of the problems I think that we're going to have going forward is Trump always reneges on all of the agreements he ever makes.
Absolutely.
So why would anybody sign any agreement with the United States ever again when, you know, the next president can just tear it up? Why would Iran do any kind of agreement with him when he tore up the previous one and then bombed them during the negotiations of the current one?
I'm moving from the sort of the start of this war to closer to where we are now, unless I'm missing something. The main goal of the U.S. right now in the war with Iran seems to be opening up the Strait of Hormuz, which is now only closed by Iran in retaliation for the U.S. war in the first place. Moreover, Iran is now demanding that they keep control of the Strait in any sort of deal that is made with the U.S. and they're seeking reparations for the damage that was caused by the U.S. and Israel in this now nearly month-long war, none of which seems like it will be acceptable to Trump, who cannot stand to lose face. So is there any foreseeable way out of this madness as you see it, Digby?
You know, I wish I did. I mean, I wish I saw something that appeared to be doable at this point. But I don't know. I mean, if we're dealing with the people we're dealing with, which is Iran, which is, you know, I mean, they're intransigent in the best of times, and they are now in a fight for their survival.
Yeah.
It's very clear that Israel is intent upon completely destroying the regime. And, you know, Trump would say, well, it's not regime change. But of course, then he said again, what was it yesterday? Maybe it was today, that, well, yeah, I mean, it's pretty much been regime change, even though it hasn't been. I mean, but this is like, this is the chaos that we're dealing with. So it's very hard to see how you get out of this. And everything I've been reading from the experts and people who know much better than I about how these things work, they don't know how you get out of it either. You're hearing people like General Mattis, the former defense secretary in Trump's first term, going out there and saying, we're screwed, basically.
Yeah.
We're stuck. And this is and when you think about the ramifications, not just for world peace, which is definitely on the table here, because this is a very, very volatile situation and very unpredictable. But the world economy, I mean, this is hanging by a thread now, waiting for Trump to taco. And I don't think he can. Where does he go? What does he do? I mean, he and the Ayatollah, strike a deal where he's going to, like, as you pointed out in your opening, they're going to run the Strait of Hormuz together.
Yes.
I mean, what in the world is he talking about? Yeah. Oh, my God.
And the idea that he is just so, I mean, he was sort of giddy about it. You know, he's been visiting Graceland in the middle
he's
of the war.
He's losing his mind.
He's kind of losing
his mind.
Well, don't get ahead of me because I'm going to get to that, believe me, in a minute. But as long as on the point of the world economy, Gareth Ramsey, the chief economist for BP, used to be called British Petroleum, BP, speaking about the Iran war's impact on energy markets, suggests that it was even that what's going on now is even worse than the oil embargoes of the 1970s. He said, quote, "We've not seen anything like this. There's been no disruption of this scale in the past. It's every oil analyst's study piece or worst nightmare." One that we never thought would happen. Well, Driftglass, nobody ever thought that Donald Trump would become president once, much less twice, I guess. Mm-hmm. But this all came out of the blue so much. And, you know, for like we said, no good reason and everything else. It's almost impossible to believe that it's happening. I don't think we have caught up with how bad this is. Setting aside the military issue for the moment, but on the economic level, as Digby suggests.
Yeah, all of the knock-on effects. I mean, first of all, congratulations to Iran for figuring out a way to have Donald Trump make them wealthier, you know, which is amazing. I mean, in effect, yep. since he is yep. sort of letting Iranian tankers through, he is helping to fund the opposition in his own war. He's helping mm-hmm. them pay for killing U.S. soldiers and bombing our allies in the region. He's doing the same thing with Russia. So this is like the Sheriff Bart, you know, strategy from Blazing Saddles. You know, he puts the gun to his own head and says, I'll shoot. I will. I swear to God, I will. And except all the rest of us are trapped in that nightmare.
The other part of this is, you know, in addition to begging Iran to end the blockade of the Strait of Hormuz, which was not in place until he launched the war, the war now, other than that, the war seems to be about one other thing, which is finding new ways to trick Wall Street into believing the war, really this time, you guys, we won. It's almost totally over. I mean, is Wall Street going to continue to get punked by Trump's incredibly obvious scams on that seemingly every other day?
Sure. Of course they are. But out in the real world, Wall Street is just the casino, you know, and they're just gambling on Donald Trump doing whatever Donald Trump's going to do. And they're going to be winners and losers. This mysterious buy order that went in 5 minutes before Donald Trump announced that he's postponing bombing the crap out of the electrical infrastructure in Iran, that made somebody out there or some group of people rich, reeks of insider trading. So it isn't just the dumbest war you've ever heard of. It is the most corrupt administration in history, mm-hmm. carrying out the dumbest war in history. But that is all at one level. Below that level are where real people live. And I live in farm country. And fertilizer prices are going to go through the roof. Mm-hmm. And that means farmers are going to have a much harder time planting and raising crops. Mm-hmm. Diesel prices are going through the roof, which means deliveries to everything everywhere are going to go up. This is exactly the issue that Trump ran on. I'm going to make your life better and cheaper. Gas is going to go down. Price of everything is going to go down. You can't wish that away. That's like trying to wish away gravity. It is not going to work. So Wall Street might very well go ahead and do what Wall Street does, and because it's so deeply divorced from the lives of real people now. But out here in the real world, a whole bunch of red state voters are about to get hammered, and there's nothing that can be done about it. Everything is already in motion to the point where you can't stop what's already rolling downhill. Mm. You can only mitigate it at some point. And the way you mitigate that is by electing a whole bunch of Democrats in the fall and refusing across the board to fund this madness.
Well, if the cycle that you mentioned before, Bill, about how Republican presidents, they always do this, well, then the next step would be financial crisis.
Yep.
That a Democrat then gets elected to clean up and get attacked over for doing it wrong.
Yes, exactly.
We have, like I said, we've ridden through this rodeo before. Digby, it seems that, I don't want to even ask you if you think there's going to be boots on the ground at this point, because I suspect that, with the start of the war, Trump doesn't even know at this point, and he'll just pull that trigger at some point. But it sure seems like that's on its way towards happening. Thousands of troops headed to the Middle East at this point. But my fear is, above and beyond putting boots on the ground, putting troops in danger, the political ramifications of all of that, of course. But my fear is, you know, we deploy a bunch of ground troops And we see something like we saw, well, a big number of them suddenly get killed in an attack, akin to the attack on the U.S. the barracks in Beirut during the Reagan administration, killed about 250 troops at once. Reagan had the common sense to pull out of Beirut after that. But if something like that happens under Donald Trump, who's, you know, twisted sociopathy simply cannot stand to be seen as losing in something like that. What does Trump do in a situation like that? That's what kind of terrifies me.
Yeah, you keep asking me this. I mean, do I get a chill down my spine and just have to say, you know, I think a lot of very terrible things are on the table. Let's just put it that way. You know, you hear this talk on the right where they're getting a little excited over there and starting to talk about using the might of the U.S. military in ways that haven't been used since the end of World War II. And you keep hearing this kind of
end
stuff.
End of World War II. End of war. Yeah. Something that rings a bell.
Something happened. And so, you know, you hear, I mean, they already used the big bunker buster bomb, right, to bomb out the nuclear facilities last summer. That's the biggest bomb that exists short of nuclear weapons. And it is incredibly destructive. They used that without a second thought. And that was not new. They'd used it once before in Afghanistan, but it had never been used. And it was Trump, too, who did it. It had never been used before because the destruction was so mighty. And you also kind of wanted to keep it under wraps so that people didn't know how destructive it was.
Right.
It would be used more as a threat than an actual thing. So Trump has no problem doing that, right? Yeah, use it. And we remember in the first term, he was saying, why can't we have more nuclear weapons? What are you talking about? I want as many nuclear weapons as I want more than we had in the 1960s. And everybody's going, ixnay, no, ixnay on the nuclear nay, you know, I mean, yes. This is bad. No, let's not do that. So, you know, I mean, I don't mean to say that that's where we're going, but I'm just saying, you know, I think that that's the kind of thing that's on the table.
And that's what really has me concerned. And Drift, I got to get to a break here shortly. So let me, and I want to get all three of you in on this particular question. I don't know that I have felt this way previously until recent days here, but I am really starting to think that this guy needs to be 25th amendmented. I mean, you know, removed from office. I know many will say that means, well, J.D. Vance would become president. Got to tell you what. At this point, I'm really concerned with the mental state of Donald Trump, and I'm actually thinking I would feel more confident with J.D. Vance in charge, as scary as that idea may be. Let me get the thoughts from the three of you on that. I'll Drift Glass, let's start with you.
Well, that's wishful thinking. I'm all for wishful thinking, but the machinery required to invoke the 25th Amendment involves his cabinet turning on him, his vice president turning on him, a majority, I believe, in Congress turning on him, and then him not objecting to it, which would kick it up to another level. So,
I agree, but I'm not saying it can happen or will happen. I'm saying just the idea that I think it should happen, that though it would be, you know, J.D. Vance as our next president, I'm feeling better about that than I am about Donald Trump as our president.
Yeah. There's a long list of things that should be true. And that's near the top of mine. Mine involve the Electoral College, the Supreme Court, and fully funding and Medicare for all. And yeah, I would take J.D. Vance tomorrow because he is sinister and he is evil. But I think he has a sense of survival, which Trump no longer has. Trump is in the late stages of his life. He's lost his mind and he lashes out irrationally anytime anybody brushes up against his ego.
Digby, you want to? Would you rather have J.D. Vance at this point?
Well, that's a tough one, but yeah, I mean, obviously Trump is losing it, but I just want to add one thing. You know, when we're talking about him and his, you know, only playing to his base, I actually think he's moving beyond that. I don't think he cares about them either anymore. I think he's playing for history. Yep. I think they're talking in his ear, that little Lindsey Grahams and all the rest of them are talking in his ear about how he's reaching for greatness. He's building all these monuments to himself. He's going to do the big arch of, you know, triumph, and he's doing all this stuff. I think he thinks that it's almost better if people hate him now for doing what he, quote, says is right, even though it's basically a coin flip or just some impulsive decision that he's made, because he believes that everything will come out okay in the end. And in the end, history will see him as a great, great man.
Sure.
And that is one of the most dangerous things I can imagine, because it means he can do anything. He is convinced that no matter what it is he does, in the end, he will be shown to have been right. You know, he has a hat that says that. Donald Trump has always been right
about everything. Yeah.
So, you know, I really think that's the scary thing, is that, so yeah, let's get rid of him because he's lost his mind. And this is nuts.
I got to get out, Dez, Trump or Vance.
What Digby said. And Drift Glass as well. Yes, 25th Amendment, where, you know, these are all bad choices that we have ahead.
Impeachment,
so let's at least not yet, but until
we can pull the madman out.
The
table.
Just the idea that I realized this week that I would prefer, I would feel more comfortable with J.D. Vance in charge, surprised the hell out of me. All right, we got to take a quick break here. We will come back to maybe talk about some domestic-ish politics from recent days, maybe even some thoughts on the 2026 midterms and lessons, if there are any, from the primaries recently held in Driftglass's beloved home state of Illinois. And who knows what else, as Digby and Driftglass are with us for the full hour today. I'm Brad Friedman. Don't go away. You are listening to The Bradcast.
You're listening to the American Democracy Minute, keeping your government by and for the people. In March 2025, President Trump's DOGE team cut the career workforce of the Cybersecurity Infrastructure and Security Agency, or CISA, by one-third, including cyber threat intelligence and response experts. Do those cuts in the war with Iran put U.S. election cybersecurity at risk? March 18th, senators pressed fellow senator and nominee for Department of Homeland Security Secretary Mark Wayne Mullins on whether he would restore cuts to staff and funding to CISA. He dodged those questions. From February to November 2025, DOGE and then DHS Secretary Kristi Noem terminated an estimated 1,000 CISA employees, including specialists assisting state election officials in hardening election systems from foreign and domestic attack threats, and froze the funding for those improvements. Under the second Trump administration, the agency has yet to have a permanent director. During the Mullins hearing Wednesday, Michigan Senator Gary Peters stated, "This administration has also gutted our nation's main cybersecurity agency, once again forcing out or reassigning highly talented personnel, slashing budgets, and limiting the agency's work to help private companies address significant cyber attacks and protect Americans from criminal hackers and support secure elections," unquote. We've linked to several reports on the gutting of CISA at AmericanDemocracyMinute.org. I'm Brian Beal.
Hey, this is Brad. Please consider supporting whichever progressive media outlet is supporting you and the things that you care about. Most, just like us, do not receive corporate or political support. We all need your support to counter the powerful corporate media echo chamber. Right now, as much as ever. If you choose to support us, you can do it really easily, safely, and quickly via bradblog.com/donate. From Desi Doyen and myself, thank you.
We've won this. This war has been won.
I'm winning. I'm winning. I'm winning. I'm winning.
Yeah. You know what? I am tired of all this winning. Please, sir, we can't take it anymore. No more winning, please. Welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com, along with our roundtable pals, Heather Digby Parton of Salon, Driftglass of the Professional Left Podcast, and of course, Desi Doyen of the Bradcast. As noted at the top of the show, it was another remarkable win, I guess, for Donald Trump on Tuesday night. He just keeps winning in that special election for the Florida State House District that includes Mar-a-Lago, where the Republican candidate endorsed by Trump lost to the Democrat in a district that Trump had won by 11 points in 2024. Just another in a long series of Democratic Party triumphs, frankly, in elections since the beginning of Trump's second term. We are, of course, focusing incredibly closely on this program on the 2026 midterms, what I see as the first step on our way out of all of these nightmares. To that end, statewide primaries for 26 are happening now, most recently in Illinois a week or so ago, longtime home state of the one and only Driftglass, where we were informed, Driftglass, by Axios on the night of the election that it did not go well for the progressive left. According to their coverage, their headline, quote, "The squad left suffers complete wipeout in Illinois." That sounds bad. Sounds like Democrats better move as far right as they can, I would argue, in every state this year to avoid being wiped out by Republicans this November. Your thoughts?
Oh, yeah, of course, Axios is right. You know, they clearly that, you know, we don't have a progressive governor who is going to win at a walk. And his lieutenant governor, despite the fact that she won the Democratic primary and is extraordinarily progressive and a wonderful voice and will walk into the Senate over the broken body of her opponent in the fall. The progressives are just on the run everywhere. It's very sad. It's very sad to watch. They don't know what the hell they're talking about. There are a variety of different candidates who won in variety of different districts because that's how the universe works. But I'll tell you this, our own Congresswoman, Nikki Baczynski, came into office two and a half elections ago, as a farm bill, gun, you know, safety, centrist, just a farm girl, you know, didn't want to offend anyone. And this election, we're getting mailings saying, we want to impeach Kristi Noem, get rid of ICE, eat the rich, you know. And so the people who are running for office have figured out that the base is now requiring of them a certain level of seriousness and anger that was not there before. Now, Kat Abu Ghazaleh, I believe that's how you pronounce her name, did not win in the up in where I used to live, the Jan Schakowsky's district up in Chicago. But she's not going anywhere. She did really well. She fundraised like crazy. She they called her a carpetbagger because she just showed up one day and started running there. But she did very well.
Yep.
And the person who won that election, Mr. Bierce, I believe, or Biss from Evanston, is no slouch. He'll be a fine congressperson when he wins. But she's not going anywhere. The progressive left isn't going anywhere. The issues are all on our side. And so, for example, in the 15th, Nazi Mary Miller won her primary because that's what happens. But a woman named Jennifer Todd, I believe is her full name. We met her, came to the 13th district looking for support and got it. And she's a nurse and she's practical and she's awesome and she's a good spokesperson. And she won the Democratic primary in that very, very Republican district.
Well,
so if you look across the board, progressive issues are winning, even if specific progressive candidates, you know, have to wait their turn.
Okay, well, I'm going to mark that down then as one vote that the left did not suffer complete wipeout in Illinois.
That's correct.
And
that's
I'll move correct. Out here to California. Well, there actually could be what. Never mind the war. You know, never mind the gas prices. If you look at what's going on in California, we've got our own statewide primaries coming up. Not for a couple of months. It's on June 2nd. But at the moment, Digby, Democrats may be a bit on edge for real, I think. We now have out here what's called the top two primary, sometimes known as a Cajun primary or jungle primary, where all candidates of all parties run together on the same ballot. The top two vote getters of any party go on to the general election in November. Well, right now, with a whole bunch of Democrats running and just two Republicans of note, troubling news for Democrats in recent polls, it seems. The two Republicans are leading in those polls. One is a sheriff in Riverside County. The other is a former Fox News host. They have about 16% or 17% support each, but that's enough to put them at the top of the polls. With the leading Democrats right now, former Congresswoman Katie Porter, current Congressman Eric Swalwell, and billionaire Tom Steyer, each coming in with about 10%. Digby, are we looking at a recipe for a Democratic Party disaster in this very blue state that Axios would love to write about?
Well, you would know better than I. You follow this stuff very closely. And, you know, I'm just sort of, you know, reading the paper every day. I'm not really, you know, delving too deeply into it. But I hate the jungle primary for this very reason, because this is a possibility.
Oh,
and
yeah.
It seems ridiculous to me. I never really got, oh, I need people that are moderates, that both parties can. I'm going, how do you see that? You know, how does that actually play out? Because I haven't actually seen that play out. Having said that, you know, I have to, this is a very Democratic state. And, you know, polling before the redistricting, you know, referendum that we just mm-hmm. had.
Prop 50 showed, last year.
Yeah. I mean, that one originally showed that it would, you know, it was underwater. I mean, it was at 36%, something like that, which I didn't hear till much later but they went ahead and did it. And as they, you know, as the election came closer and there was lots of press about it and people started talking about it, you know, it was a walk away, you know, they absolutely killed it. And so, you know, I have to, you know, just hold out hope that somehow or another, the Democrats do come out and that they, I guess, rally around a couple of these Democrats and leave others, you know. I mean, Tom Steyer, for instance, he's a billionaire. He's got a lot of ads on. I would assume
he's the only ad I've seen. Yeah. He's constantly on the air.
It's everywhere.
Everywhere you look, it's Tom Steyer ad. And by the way, I have seen zero ads from anyone else.
Yeah. And in California, you know, in California, ads are ads, you know, I mean, they're very expensive, but people tend to do it. And I did see an Eric Swalwell one actually yesterday.
Huh, okay.
It was the first time I'd seen it. And
yeah.
It was actually pretty good.
Okay.
But so he's starting. But in any case, I just, you know, I just have to feel like in this state of all states that this isn't going to happen. But God help us. You know, wouldn't that be something?
Well, if you're
that guy out in Riverside, that sheriff out
yeah.
there.
Yeah.
He just went and seized a bunch of ballots from the 2024 election in Riverside.
From the 2025 election. That was from the special the Prop 50 election. That
yeah.
guy who seized 650,000 ballots from Riverside County, he is among the two Republicans that
yes.
are currently leading these polls.
Yes.
For governor.
I mean, if that guy becomes the governor of California, I don't know what to say. I mean,
I know.
Because of some fluke like this. I mean, that's ridiculous.
But it's a fluke that folks predicted when the jungle primary was set up. I think voters voted that in. And it was like, you know, be careful what you wish for here. I think
exactly.
It's probably too soon. I hope it's too soon to predict that voters haven't begun to really pay attention to the governor's primary yet. That's what my hope is, and that they have just not consolidated or coalesced yet around anyone.
Early voting starts in April for that election, so just weeks away from that. I'm sure it'll all work out just fine. Hey, guys, I wanted to thank you as ever for stopping on by. A delight speaking with both of you. You can find Heather Digby Parton and her fine work over at salon.com as well as digbysblog.net. You can also find and follow her on The Blue Skies at Digby56. Driftglass, on the other hand, can be found at his blog, driftglass.blogspot.com. Or if you would like many, many more deep cut references, like some of those he sampled here, Shrinky Dinks, the first season of Star Trek, and German kinetic sculptures. You'll get more of that at the Pro Left Podcast, which you can download anytime at proleftpod.com. He is on The Blue Skies at Driftglass. Delightful speaking with both of you. God knows what will be happening the next time we do, but I look forward to it in any case. Thanks, guys.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Thank you. And I have one recommendation.
Yeah.
For legacy purposes.
Yeah.
Shooting for history. Look up Percy Shelley's Ozymandias.
Ah.
Percy. Yeah.
Okay.
Shelley's Ozymandias. It's all about Ozymandias, King of Kings. Look upon my works, ye mighty, and despair. And there's nothing left of it. There's nothing left of it, but broken rubble and sand. So take a look.
Alternatively, you could check out Caligula, because that's the whole story.
All right. I got to go. I can hear them already heading over to the Pro Left Podcast for more of that. Thanks, guys. Bye.
Thank you.
Bye.
Okay, well, let me. I'm still right. Percy Shelley's Ozymandias. Got that?
Yes, and Caligula.
All right. You familiar with those references?
I am.
Okay.
They're quite good.
Okay.
He's right.
Okay. And I'm terrified just by the thought. Anyway, yeah, we got to get out. But let's see. Quick note here. A couple of quick notes here. The No Kings rally coming up over the weekend.
On March 28th, Saturday.
Saturday.
Look up nokings.org if you want to find a place, a protest that is near your community, because they are dispersed throughout the United States.
And number two, so we were scheduled to take next week off for spring break. Are we still doing that?
Yes.
Okay, we're taking next week off for spring break. We will be back after Easter. However, we're leaving a little bit early because, well, poor Desi needs a little bit of medical work, a little bit of medical attention.
Yes, unfortunately. So we got to take a day off a bit early and so I can get that taken care of.
A root canal.
Yeah.
In other words, she would rather have a root canal than do this show for one more day. Now, in truth, she's been in great pain for the past week, so I thank you for...
your indulgence on this
for
one.
Getting,
thank
I thank you for getting through it over the past week until we can get you that done. So that's that. I just wanted to let you know why we are leaving a little bit early, a little bit earlier than we had planned. We will also... Desi is such a champion, however, that we will have a Green News report tomorrow before your root canal surgery?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you. Good
You're
for
welcome.
You. I appreciate that. So then thereafter, we will see you after Easter. Thanks again to our guest today, Heather Digby Parton of Salon, and also Drift Glass of Pro Left Podcast, and to the aforementioned Desi Doyen and her poor tooth, our producer here. Thanks to all of you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. If you missed any portion of today's show or any other, you can always download them for free at bradblog.com. And by the way, I have been threatening for some time a new Bradblog server, new Bradblog design. That is all moving forward, thanks in no small part to those of you who hit the donate button at bradblog.com. to help us not only stay on your public airwaves, but also to finally make some improvements at bradblog.com. That some of that is going to be happening in the next couple of days. And then the big changeover to hopefully a brand new design within the next few weeks.
So thanks for bearing with us as the site goes through some changes.
It could use some changes.
Yes.
Anyway, that's that. Drop me an email if you like. I am bradcast@bradblog.com. You can find me on the social medias at TheBradBlog. And Desi Doyen will be looking for your Get Well Soon notes on the social medias at...
Green News Report. Come by and say hi.
Especially at Blue Sky. All right, that's it. Until we see you after Easter... I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.
You're listening to the Bradcast. We are 100% listener supported, thanks to listeners like you who drop by bradblog.com/donate.